Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, March 10th, 2024, is by the Reverend Barbara Threat on the topic of To Know the Truth.
What is true? What's real? What can we rely on? I began to reflect on these questions back in late January, when one of the headlines on the evening news was about apparently very explicit AI-generated images of Taylor Swift that were circulating and were completely not real. And, of course, in the same news broadcast, there was things about the continuing claims that the election was stolen and that various criminal charges are completely untrue, despite what seems to me like overwhelming evidence to the contrary. That same night, there was an ad for an app which allows one to quickly crop the head of someone out of a photo and put in an image that's a little bit more flattering, or perhaps even a different person. That's not new technology, I know, but it's striking in its ability to create photographic images that are not, in fact, pictures of what really happened at all. There is a buzz back on this. Can anyone else hear it, or is it just me? Okay, I can live with it. That isn't new technology, I know, but it is striking in its ability to create images which are not pictures of what happened at all. They can certainly seem so, though, and that makes it hard sometimes to determine what is real. So I've been thinking about this a lot, and I'll warn you, this is my ruminations and it's lots of questions. I don't think there are many answers. I told someone earlier what I know is real in my own life is that I will always love my daughters. That's real. I'm certain of that. But there are a lot more questions than there are answers. But all of this took my mind back to one of the most unexpected museum exhibits that I have ever seen. It was in Moscow in 2012, while I was on sabbatical. I decided to visit the Gulag History Museum. I will say I was quite surprised to discover that there was such a museum in Moscow. It doesn't match my picture of how Russia must treat its history. And I wanted to see how they had handled that. And the exhibit was sobering and sad and disturbing. But toward the end, there was a special exhibit I hadn't known was there. It was an exhibit about the manipulation of photographic images in Russian history. These weren't recent photos, and they weren't changed with AI, generated with AI, or changed with Photoshop, or whatever was advertised on TV. These alterations were done between 1922 and 1953 using scalpels and glue and airbrushes and paint and needles. They included images from as far back as the late 1800s. There was an image of one young man in a picture of several young socialists taken in 1897. And by the time it was published a few decades later, he had been found to be a spy and executed. So all there was where he was a bit of kind of a glow on the wall behind him. He was gone. In a picture produced in 1917, using a photo taken several years earlier, there was a sign on a store in the background that originally read clocks, silver, and gold. And it was replaced with, take what's yours through struggle. And a dark, illegible banner had gained clearly printed words, down with the monarchy. So this altered picture became photographic proof that there was evidence of support for the revolution back in 1917. The exhibit included children's school books with manipulated pictures. One was purportedly taken in 1926, and it shows Stalin standing alone and looking very powerful next to a table covered with important-looking documents. It was included in a textbook just a few decades ago, and the exhibit showed that textbook. But the original 1926 picture of Stalin has three other party bosses standing beside him. He doesn't look particularly important at all. And as those men fell out of favor, or were executed or exiled, their image was removed. So that manipulated one showing just Stalin was the one which showed up in the textbooks. That's the one the children saw and the history they learned. Stalin, powerfully alone and decisive. And it was false. As I began to work on this sermon, I came across a report that said that roughly 30% of Americans still believe that Trump really won the 2020 elections, or would have without massive voter fraud, despite what seems to me to be very conclusive evidence that neither of those is true. I don't like that statistic, but it didn't surprise me. What was shocking was the statistic that apparently about 12% of Americans believe that Neil Armstrong's moonwalk was faked. It was filmed somewhere in Nevada or Utah. And 10% of Americans supposedly still believe that the Earth is flat. According to a recent Gallup poll, 58% of Republicans agree with the statement that God created humans in their present form within the last 10,000 years. And 41% of Democrats agreed with that statement also. But science, I want to scream. Index fossils and the distribution of related species and genetic change and parallel anatomy. I was a geology major for a while. These are all proof of evolution, irrefutable proof. And yet 17 of our states now allow the teaching of creationism in some form or another in their publicly funded schools. Science be damned. So what's real? Does believing that the Earth is flat make it true? Does refusing to believe you lost an election mean that you really didn't lose? Does deciding that a certain religion or ethnic group is inferior make that a fact? For that matter, does believing in God make God real? Or does believing there is no God make that true? How do we decide what is real, what we should believe? If we believe hard enough and sincerely enough, whether it's about the results of an election or when human life begins or the reasons for changing weather patterns, does our belief make that real? And we, of course, are told that you become what you think. What if we're wrong about what we believe? How do we determine what's true? All of this got me thinking about how we make those choices, both in our own lives and in the wider world. A few books ago, Dr. Charan Ranganath, a professor of neuroscience at UC Davis, published a book called Why We Remember, Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters. It was reviewed in the New York Times Book Review a few weeks ago, so you may be familiar with it, and I, of course, had to order it and buy it. Ranganath points out that some of the challenges in recognizing what's real are in how we each remember things and why, and whether our own memories are entirely reliable. Studies show that approximately 40% of all police lineup identifications turn out to be incorrect. What some was certain they saw didn't turn out to be true. He mentioned a famous study, which I'd like to do here this morning. Listen carefully to these words that I'm about to read. Fear, temper, hatred, fury, happy, and rage, emotion, rage, hate, mean, ire, mad, wrath, calm, and fight. Raise your hand if you remember hearing the word fear. How about the word wrath? And the word anger? The word anger wasn't actually there. About as many people in the study said that they had heard anger as those who said they'd heard the words, fear and wrath. And the reason is because of the way that our brains work. Anger fits in the same general category as most of those words, so we just fill in the blanks. And we do that all the time. It's essential. It's part of how we survive. I get to the store and I can remember that I want these three ingredients, and then I think, I want them to make a this, and so I know what else should be on my list. It's a useful skill. It also trips us up. When we return home from a three-hour symphony that we truly, truly enjoy, we can tell somebody all about it. But it'll probably take us 5, 10, maybe 20 minutes We don't rewind and play the whole thing as if it was a video. Too often our own memories aren't nearly as reliable or accurate as we'd like to be, nor are they final. Someone can say, I was at that concert too. Did you notice that woman with the incredible purple dress who got up and walked right down the middle of the aisle? I didn't see that. There are lots of reasons for such confusion and such gaps. One, of course, is prejudices or preconceptions. Those faulty identifications in police lineups are in part because to many people, those of another race, whatever the other race is, look quite similar, even interchangeable. To those of us of white skin, there's a good chance that all the young black men with a hoodie look about the same. But there are many other reasons for our imperfect memories. Sometimes it's because each of us focuses on different things. Our attention is caught by something very different. That three-hour concert, an architect will recall the details of the concert hall. They can tell you what the ceiling looked like. A fashion designer will notice the dress that the soloist wore. A musician will exclaim on the quality or lack of quality of the sound. An instrument maker focuses just on the very rare violin that the soloist played and probably can't even tell you the soloist's gender. It's the same event, and we have very different memories. And our memories change over time. They're continually modified and updated. Chris and Pat were co-workers for years, worked closely together, but they both retired a year ago, and they haven't seen one another since then. One day, Chris spots Pat at the other end of an aisle in the grocery store and hurries to catch up, curious to see what news Pat might have about other co-workers or hear how Pat's retirement is going. Pat doesn't seem to want to talk at all. Pat is brusque to the point of rudeness and quickly makes an excuse to leave. And Chris is baffled. Pat was always such a social, friendly person. But now Chris experiences Pat as being rude and dismissive and downright unpleasant. Chris feels a bit offended and decides to completely avoid Pat if they should ever meet again. A few days later, Chris runs into another coworker and mentions how Pat has changed. Pat has become unfriendly and rude, even icy. And the coworker says, "Oh, you must not have heard. Pat's partner was diagnosed with a brain tumor shortly after we retired, and just a month ago, Pat's partner died. Apparently, it was a horrible death. I've heard the relationship between Pat and the stepkids has become really difficult, too. I imagine it's pretty hard for Pat to function at all these days." And Chris's interpretation of that exchange in the store probably changes radically. It's very likely that now Chris would describe Pat as having seemed distracted and overwhelmed, sad and even despondent, and Chris probably feels a lot of compassion. It's a memory of the same thing, but it has changed radically. The encounter itself hasn't changed, but what Chris thinks as he looks back, the memory of the event has altered. It's updated with new information, and we do that all the time. So which memory is real? Which one should you trust in the long run? Ranganath points out that memories are fluid. Every memory, he points out, He points out that there are two quite distinctive types of memory. One is what actually happened to me directly, and the other is what I learned. I do remember moving out of home to go to college, for example. Or where I was when I heard about the Twin Towers falling on 9/11. I also remember plenty of details about the Transcendentalists and the date that the Berlin Wall fell, although I certainly did not live in the 1840s, nor was I in Berlin in November of 1989. Neither type of memory is set in concrete, though. What we remember, whether it's a personal memory or a general information memory, can be and often is amended or expanded or even outright contradicted as we gain more information. What we thought was real turns out not to be. I think, for example, of the shift in public perception of Thomas Jefferson, When I was in grade school, he was a tremendous hero. He's still done things we know that he still has done things that we think are important, writing the Declaration of Independence. But we also know that he owned slaves and fathered several children with one of them. So our assessment of him changes. We rewrite what we know and what is real. Trusted doctors in the mid-1900s actively encouraged pregnant women to take up smoking as a way to keep their weight down. And now we know that is horrible advice. Once again, what's real shifts and changes. And that happens repeatedly in life as we learn more and more about situations. What we know for certain and what we're sure we can rely on shifts over time, and that can be unsettling or even confusing. Ranganath also emphasizes that as well as establishing our past, one of the purposes of memory is to help us orient toward the future. Our past is a useful tool. This person has been unreliable 14 times, so don't count on them the 15th. Chris is gaining a broader understanding of Pat's demeanor. Could help Chris to be slower to rush to judgment in the future, more compassionate. As we learn more and are willing to include more into our memory banks, our decision-making places, we gain more insight. And the more open we are to adjusting our memories to including that new information, the greater chance that there is that our memory will be helpful if we go forward. If I say that person has let me down 14 times, but maybe this will be the one when they get it right, I'm being foolish. It isn't always easy to update things. We do tend to seek out information that will confirm what we want to believe in our personal lives. If I've decided that this person is wise, it may be hard for me to question their judgment, sometimes to my own peril. If I've decided that that one is a selfish jerk, it may be difficult for me to acknowledge that others may see them as generous. It may be even more personal. If I see myself as being kind, I'm more likely to emphasize in my own memory the incidents where I acted with kindness. And I may have a hard time admitting the places where I was mean-spirited or judgmental. But my memory of myself as well as others will be more useful if I allow it to include the parts that don't fit easily. What's real or true is rarely perfect or pure or one-sided. In fact, that may be one of the ways to determine what is real. If, as we accept our lives, the things that are real to us, the things that are true, are always the ones that make us feel comfortable, we're probably missing some things, because life isn't that simple. What about in the larger sphere? How do we determine what is real there? 10 days ago, it appears that there was an Israeli attack on Palestinians who were waiting to receive aid. At last count, over 100 people, over 120, the numbers are still changing, were killed, and many more were injured, some gravely. We've all read about the brutality of the Hamas attacks on October 7. We've already read about the nearly 30,000 Palestinians that have been killed since then. It's estimated that at least 90% of all Palestinians have been displaced, unhoused, underfed, and in many cases, completely unfed. But who's doing the counting of those figures? Who even could count accurately in such situations? How do we determine what's real? I spoke a couple months ago about the question of blame, and that's one of the complicated places to figure out where blame is. But how do we even start to figure out who to blame or what to do about it if we can't even trust the facts that we're getting? What reality is and whose reality takes priority does depend to some extent on what we believe is real. What's true is that Jews have been persecuted and hunted for centuries, and the country of Israel has been repeatedly attacked since its inception. What's just as true is that Palestinians have been pushed out of the land they lived on for centuries, often by Israelis, and there were statements clearly dismissing them back in 1910, 1917. What's real is that there is no easy answer for the Middle East, and I want there to be one. So I think do most of the people in our world. But that ambiguity is part of the dilemmas that we face every day. We humans like answers. We want facts, especially those of us who like science. And certainly we want to know what's true, what we can rely on. We can even create entirely false narratives and then decide that they're true, and I think we see that happening in the wider world. We become so attached to those narratives that it becomes impossible to even question them, which just makes the whole dilemma harder. And what we believe is true matters. We know that words and thoughts can and do lead to action. I think about all the angst that there's been recently about policies at various colleges and what they should be and who should enforce them and what they should mean and what they might lead to. People all across our country are putting up signs supporting their favorite political candidate and holding rallies and debates because they believe that those gestures matter. They believe that what is on their sign is true and that letting people know about that will make a change. We've witnessed a great deal of debate recently about free speech and what's hate speech, even advocacy for violence. Because we know that at least sometimes thoughts and words do lead to actions. So is the people calling for violence against either Israelis or Palestinians or the larger ethnic groups of Jews or Arabs or Muslims, is that the same as acting on those calls? What's real? And what words can we trust? And what should it call of us? Should free speech include intentionally spreading untruths? And what about the things that we really believe are true at the moment? Those doctors back in the 1950s really did believe that it was a good thing to keep your weight down. And so go ahead and start smoking. It's healthy for you. I circle back to those altered photos in the Gulag Museum exhibit. Clearly those were altered with the intent to support the revolution because people believed that the words and images would have power. Even if it was a false one, even if it was one that they completely created and knew was wrong. What's more, they were comfortable trying to manipulate history, trying to create an illusion of what might have been real, what they wished was real, to help their cause. And doing that didn't stop back then. For what causes, I wonder, is it permissible to create an illusion? Where is it okay to intentionally deceive? How can we define truth and what is morally acceptable for us to do in pursuit of the truth? And those are kind of high philosophical questions and I think on a much more mundane level about the time when my then 3-year-old daughter's cat was killed, hit by a car. And I told her that the cat had moved to the farm next door to be with its sweetheart cat rather than telling her the truth, which was that it had been hit by a car. I buried the cat where I knew she wouldn't find it, and I scraped every hair off that road so she'd believe my lie, and it was a lie. So when is it okay to manipulate reality, to intentionally create an illusion, because that's what I was doing? When is it ethical to manipulate the truth, either through words or through actions? Does it matter what our goal is? What if it's for power, or for justice, or for ease? There was a report on the news this morning about a scientist, I've forgotten, Cal or Stanford or somewhere, that they've just determined has been manipulating DNA evidence for centuries or for decades. To what end and what's the cost and how does one make that decision? Sometimes it seems like the most applicable words when determining what's real are found in our 7 principles, and the one that's hanging back on that wall. The free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Those words I find to be the most important in that and the most challenging are a responsible search. Responsible demands that we explore and consider viewpoints and ideas that don't mesh with what we believe or with how we want the world to be or with what we find to be true for us. Responsible means dealing with ambiguity and contradictions and incompleteness. It means that sometimes we have to accept that what's real is not what we wish it was. And search means that we have to keep on asking questions, keep on trying to learn more. And more is not always synonymous with more of what I agree with or more things that back up what I already believe. learning more, searching, continuing to say, I don't have all the answers. I don't quite know what's real here. It may be that our honest search will reinforce what we know, and I often hope it does, and what I believe, and that the search will be gratifying or even comforting. But if our search always confirms what we already want to be true, what we know to be true, then we're probably not really searching. We're just confirming. What's real will be messy, at least sometimes, because that's how life is. So what's real? I close with words from Reverend Paige Getty, a minister at the UU Congregation of Columbia, Maryland, who writes, as responsible religious seekers, we recognize that we are privileged to be free, to have the resources to pursue life beyond mere survival, to continually search for truth and meaning, and to exist beyond the bonds of dogma and oppression, to wrestle freely with truth and meaning as they evolve. This privilege calls us not to be isolated or self-centered, believing that our single perspective outweighs all others, but rather to be humble, to be open to the great mysteries of truth and meaning that life offers. And those mysteries may speak to us through our own intuition and experience, but also through tradition and community, conflict, nature, relationships, and continued questions. As a faith tradition, Unitarian Universalism makes sacred the right and responsibility to engage in this free and responsible quest as an act of religious devotion. Institutionally, we have left open the questions of what truth and meaning are, acknowledging that mindful people will, in every age, discover new insights. May we keep searching responsibly for what is true and right, and for what is uncomfortable and unsettling, as well as those things that make us say, ah, I got it right. May we continue to look for what brings justice and kindness and wholeness and confusion. Amen.